I know some of you are probably trying to figure out what all my Freundschaft is, so I'll tell you that my mother was Fanny Bender Miller, married to Floyd Miller. And I grew up in a home. My father died when I was 5 years old, and my mother was also a stepmother to my father's, the children that he had with his first wife. So that was a different experience, too, than what a lot of people have. I would like to say that I have four children. Benjamin is 5 and a half. He's in kindergarten this year. He's a little more the studious type of person. Timmy will be 4 on Tuesday, and Timmy's philosophy in life is that if it isn't risky or daring, it isn't fun. And Jason is 2 and a half, and he's learned to play offensive as well as defensive. And Sarah Beth is 4 months old, and Dave Slabo is my husband. Okay, there is a story that Patsy Claremont tells in a book that she wrote that is called God Can Use Crackpots, where she says that she had a real problem with her temper, and she finally decided that before she would ever discipline her children, that she would pray with them. And one day, one of her sons did something that made her really, really angry, and she was coming at them just like a volcano, ready to just erupt. And she was coming across the room, and her little boy looked up at her and said, "Mom, wait, stop, why don't we pray first?" Isn't it funny how sometimes our children know what our needs are a little bit better than we do? In talking about the art of being a mother, I started thinking about what does it mean, art? What is art? When I think of somebody who is an artist, I think of somebody who draws or somebody who is a painter. So I went to Webster's Dictionary, and I found out that art is something that is performed, of course, by an artist. It involves any specific skill or its application. It involves dexterity, expertise, capability, competence, and proficiency. Did you know that you are all of those if you are a mother? An artist majors in the doing of things that display form, bends, and unusual perception. So as a mother, you are an artist. And before I go on, I would like to say that if there are those of you here who are not mothers, don't feel that I'm distinguishing against you. Those of you maybe who are grandmothers who have raised your children, I hope that you can still maybe take something from this tonight and use it with some of the children that you still have around you, or with your grandchildren. And I hope it can be a profitable time for everybody. As a mother, you are an artist. Now, where does an artist work? She has her own studio, and she has her own abilities. You know, there can be many kinds of painters, and they can paint the same scene, but they will all give a different slant to it. And I think it's important that we realize that each of us have our own abilities that we individually have that nobody else has. So, as a mother, you are an artist, and you have a studio, and you have a career in motherhood. So tonight I'd like to talk about the dimension of being a mother and of viewing it as an art and of taking care of your studio. We're going to talk about your maintenance, your monuments, your management, your memories, your moments, your magnitude, and your memoirs. First of all, in your studio, you have an environment, and Pete was talking about that tonight, about when you walk into somebody's home and you just feel like they really would rather if you were not there. You've heard the expression of the air was so thick you could have cut it with a knife. That does not give you a very welcome feeling, does it? You are the creator of an environment, the atmosphere in your home. Home is a place that is for people and not things. It should be a place that is a safe place, a place that makes you want to come home. Our home is an opportunity for us to express ourselves in the way we arrange things and just in the way we domesticate it. It says something about us. It says something about what we believe about God in us. Now, I'm a mother of small children, and I would like to say that our home should be a place of order, and it should be. And I'm not talking about not having toys all over the floor, but there can be a sense of orderliness about the home, even in the atmosphere, even if there are a lot of toys around. A house which is clean and free from excessive clutter provides a stronger framework around which we are able to create a home. At the same time, a woman must be able to complete a home without being consumed by it. Our home should have an atmosphere of rest and peace, a feeling of, come in and sit down a spell. I'm glad you're here. And especially to our husband or our children, it should say, I'm so glad that you belong to me. Whatever the house that you live in, whether it's an apartment or a trailer, whatever the size or whatever the financial state that you find yourself in, you can make your house, your dwelling place, a home. You can do it by your attitude. Eugenia Price, in one of the books that she wrote, said, it isn't the woman's task that makes a home peaceful and creative. It's the woman herself. Think about that. When you've been in places, in tiny, cooped-in places, the woman who is there is the one who creates that atmosphere that lets you know whether she is glad you're there or wishes that you were not. There is a saying that says, if mama ain't happy, ain't nobody happy. And I think that's really true. I really believe that the mother is the hub around which the wheel revolves. We have the choice in our day-to-day walk in life, in the way we respond to life situations, to be a calm in the center of the storm or to be a part of the storm. Now, we've talked about atmosphere. I'd like to talk a little bit also about our attitude. One cannot create the right atmosphere without the proper attitude. And one thing that I think is so important that we all have to work on at times is our contentment quotient. It's so easy to compare our children or our spouse or our financial status, your house, your car, your clothes, etc., and, you know, think, well, if only my husband were like this one, or if only my children, you know, I didn't have this problem, or if only we lived in a bigger house, or if only this and if only that. 2 Corinthians 10:12. I used to be able to say this by heart, but since I'm a little nervous, I probably won't be able to, so I'll find it. It says, for we dare not make ourselves of the number or compare ourselves with some that commend themselves. For they, measuring themselves by themselves and comparing themselves among themselves, are not wise. Do you want to be wise? Then stop comparing yourself with other people and with other situations. Instead, we should say, you know, how can I help in this situation? How can I change me to make this place a better place? Another thing that we need to do is to recognize that motherhood, as Beverly LaHaye says in one of her books, is the highest form of femininity. And I'm not saying that if you don't have children that you're not feminine. But when you really think about that, you know, it's something that God has designed and created. It wasn't our idea. It was God's idea. Another thing in talking about our atmosphere and our attitude is our walk with God as the creator artist. If my relationship with Jesus Christ is vital, my family is going to know it, just like they're going to know it if it's not vital. They're going to know it by my love, by my willingness to listen to an idea that might be different from my own, by my patience, my personal honesty, and my obedience. It's contagious when it's authentic. And another reason besides even my personal growth, and that is so important in where I am going, is that as a mother, I have children. And Jesus Christ can only mark a child's personality in a completely creative way if he is in control of a mother's personality. If he's not in control of your personality and mine, he's not going to be able to mark our children in the way that he could if he had control of us too. A mother's marks upon her child's life will be creative too. There's a young mother who wrote a book called Keep These Things and Ponder Them in Your Heart. Her name is Miriam Rockness, and she says, a mother is not only her child's first teacher, she may be his most important one as well. There is no doubt that the personality of a child is more pliable in his early years, and that during those years he is constantly being molded by his mother or by the substitute who spends the most amount of time with him. And I don't know what situations you all are facing. I have no idea. I think the only mother I really know here is Sharon Yoder that I really feel I know a lot about. I don't know if any of you are working outside the home or if you're all at home. if you sometimes feel like, you know, being a mother at home is just really so unimportant. I had a friend one time who told me, if I have to wipe off a high chair tray one more time, I think I will scream. I do it 3 times a day, and I'm so sick and tired of it. And, you know, I understand how she feels. Like Pete was saying tonight, there are things that we do over and over again. It seems like you just keep doing them over and over again. But there is a book that is called What's a Smart Woman Like You Doing at Home? And it's written by 3 women who all used to be professional, be work in the professional field. And all 3 of them on their own decided that it wasn't worth it, that they really needed to be at home with their children. And I'd like to share just a little bit what one of them wrote. And encourage those of you who maybe are chafing under the bit or wondering if it's worth it, wondering if what you're doing is really that important, just to encourage you to really think about being a keeper at home. My children were learning lessons and making choices and being guided by the repetition of small human interchanges. The largest decisions about the direction of their future, I was learning, were made in the course of these apparently inconsequential daily interchanges. Also, there were far too many days when I just did not want to hear about what my children did during the day and how they were treated and so on. I would leave work tired and frustrated and eager to put dinner on the table, and I did not want additional problems for my children. It seemed that no matter how many checklists I consulted, how many visits I made, or references I checked, my conclusion never varied. There was no one to whom I could pay enough money to love my child. While I and most of my friends were saying that our minds were too good to stay at home and raise our children, none of us ever asked the question, then what sort of minds should be raising our children? Minds that were not very good? My carefully worded advertisements for childcare literally came back to haunt me. I was looking for someone, quote, loving, tender, reliable, responsible, nurturing, intelligent, and resourceful. I had wanted someone with a driver's license, good English, a sense of fun, and an alert, lively manner. I wanted someone who would encourage my child's creativity, take them on interesting outings, answer all their little questions, and rock them to sleep. I wanted someone who would be a part of the family. Slowly, painfully, after really thinking about what I wanted for my children and rewriting advertisement after advertisement, I came to the stunning realization that the person I was looking for was right under my nose. I had been desperately trying to hire me. So now you're a woman at home. And, you know, you look about you sometimes and you say, you know, how do you handle and cope with all the things that that entails? And being a mother at home, the main thing that you're doing is taking care of your children. And one thing that helps me to remember as I'm working with my children from day to day is that, as one mother said, when a child asked her, don't you get tired of washing dishes? And she said, I'm not washing dishes. I'm building a home, and I'm building lives. There's a poem that's called Two Builders, and I would like to share that with you, because as mothers, we are builders. We are building monuments. We all build them, and it's up to us, with the help of God, to decide what kind of monuments we're going to leave behind us. Our monuments are our children. A builder builded a temple. He wrought it with grace and skill. Pillars and groins and arches all fashioned to work his will. Men said as they saw its beauty, it shall never know decay. Great is thy skill, O builder. Thy fame shall endure for aye. A mother builded a temple with loving and infinite care, planning each arch with patience, laying each stone with prayer. None praised her unceasing efforts. None knew of her wondrous plan. For the temple the mother builded was unseen by the eyes of man. Gone is the builder's temple, crumbled into the dust. Low lies each stately pillar, food for consuming rust. But the temple the mother builded will last while the ages roll. for that beautiful unseen temple is a child's immortal soul. We are going to leave an impression. So what kind of impression are we going to leave on our children? The definition of a monument is a lasting evidence or reminder of someone or something notable. It's a testimony on a tribute. And it should be a tribute to Jesus Christ, to what Jesus Christ can do in the lives of our children, and to what he has done in our lives and our disciplines. So now we're talking about our monuments, and we're talking about building. How do we build? First of all, we build by example. Our children soon learn what is really important to us. One day, Dave's sister was going to be taking an exam, and she has a little girl, Jamie, who was about 3 years old at the time, and Grandma Slava was taking care of Jamie, and it was 2 o'clock, and it was time for Ruth to take her exam, and Grandma said, "Jamie, come sit on Grandma's lap. It's time for your mama to take her test. Let's stop and pray for her." What do you think that said to Jamie? They told her that prayer, remembering to pray for other people, was really important, and that God can help us through the little things in life. When our children see us reading our Bible, when we can come to them and we can ask them to forgive us for when we've been angry or we've disciplined incorrectly or whatever, then we are teaching by example. And, you know, there are so many scriptures that talk about forgiving one another and asking forgiveness, and none of us are so perfect that our children should never be able to say that we have never come to them and asked their forgiveness for something. I remember one day I had been grouchy, and it was the end of the day, and I had gone all day knowing that I had been grumpy with my oldest son, and I was ready to tuck him into bed, and I said, "You know, Benjamin, Mama was really kind of grouchy with you today, wasn't she?" And he said, "Yes." And I said, "You know, I was wrong, and I need to ask you to forgive me." See, he knew. And if I wouldn't have asked him, you know, maybe that one time wouldn't have mattered, but as time goes on and on and on, those are the kind of things that when they hear us talking about God and they see that we're inconsistent, we're not living, we're not being the example that we should be, those are the kind of things that are going to affect them. We teach by example, we build by example, and we build by teaching. Now, this is an old saying that has been around. I don't know if you've ever heard it. It's telling is not teaching, listening is not learning, and teaching is not training. We need to be able to teach our children to find God's standard and then to go with that. I have a friend, Dory, who lives down where we live. Her husband is not a Christian. She has 3 children, and her oldest son, Daniel, was about 11 years old. He came home from school one day. He's in the public school, and he said, "Mom, I'm supposed to find out for class tomorrow what sign I'm under. That's our assignment for today." And she didn't tell him, "Well, you know, you're not going to do that." She said, "Well, let's go see what God's Word says about that." And they went to the Bible, and they read what the Bible says about people that worship in signs and in the planets and all that. And he went to school the next day and told his teacher, he said, "I'm a Christian and I can't do that." She had taught him something from that little experience that they had together. I remember, this is something just as an extra, the scripture in Titus that talks about the older women teaching the younger. This is just kind of an extra for you all. There are certain ways that we can teach. I remember one day when our oldest son was maybe a year and a half old, and he was going through that stage where he did not want me out of his sight, and I was so frustrated with him. I felt like I could not get anything done. I could not sit and fold laundry without him being in my lap, and I was talking to my mother-in-law about this, and sometimes I might talk more about my mother-in-law than my mother, and that's because at that time we lived where it was not long distance to call my mother-in-law, and it was to call my mother. So, and, you know, she could have said to me, "You know, Gertrude, this is going to pass. You need to be patient." But she didn't. All she said to me was, "You know, it must be such a challenge to be able to meet his needs when you have so many things you want to get done." And that helped put it in such a different perspective for me. That was the way that she taught me without sitting me down and, you know, having a little sermon with me. And I remember last Christmas, Dave and I had a little problem with deciding when we were going to be able to go to Virginia, and it all related to his work. And I was very frustrated, and I had so been looking forward to going to South Boston, and we still didn't know when we were leaving. They all thought we were already on the way, and we hadn't left yet. And so I called his mother, and she knew something was wrong. She could tell by the tone of my voice, and she said, what's the problem? I said, well, I'm calling about your son, my husband. I said, I think right now he's more your son than my husband. And she said, well, I'll claim him. And that said something to me, too. Said something to me about a mother's love. And she knew that I was only half kidding. And Dave knew about it, too. So anyhow. Another way that we build our monuments is by training. Now, you know, we've talked about example. We've talked about teaching. But, you know, the way you train somebody is you have to do it one time, two times. No, you have to do it over and over and over again. It never stops. I remember as a nurse, when I was in nurse's training, one of the first things I had to learn was how to make a bed the way the nursing instructor wanted it done. And we had to learn how to make it, and they'd come and check them. They'd pull those sheets up, and they'd see if everything was tucked in the way they had taught us to do. And if it wasn't done right, we had to do it again. And that's another way that we build our monuments, is we have to not only teach, but we have to train over and over again. And those are in little things, like in picking up toys and in the chores that we give our children, in our daily devotions and the devotions that we should teach our children to have, and also in forgiveness and in restitution. I'd like to talk a little bit about discipline, because I think that comes under training. And there are many, many times that our husbands are not around, and that we have to take care of things when they're not there. And I'm not underestimating the authority of a husband or a father. True love for children requires proper discipline. A child has to know what the limits are. That's when they feel the safest. An undisciplined child will feel as though he does not belong to you, and his self-worth is going to be affected. We should never discipline in anger. I was talking to a girl this past week who grew up in a very conservative Mennonite home, and she talked about how when she would say something or, you know, sass at her mother, how she would get slapped across the room and things like that. And, you know, those are the things that she remembers. Not that what she did was not wrong, but in the way it was handled. We should not discipline in anger. There have been times when I have had to put my children on a chair, and I have had to tell them, I am too upset with you, and, you know, we will deal with this when I get myself calmed down. Oftentimes, I think in some of our discipline problems is that, you know, do you ever find yourself not agreeing with your husband when your husband is disciplining a child or in something that he thinks? Nobody ever does that? You always agree? Anybody? Well, don't talk about it in front of your children. Talk about it with your husband. You should discuss it alone. One thing that helps is if you can talk about the way you were raised and the way he was raised, and the difference of the things that you thought were right and the things that you thought were wrong, so that you can work out those things together and you can present a united front. When your husband is disciplining your children, you need to support him in front of them. And then later you can talk to him if you felt that what he did was not right. But you should never have your children feel that they can divide the two of you. We need to be consistent, and we need to take the time. And that is one of the biggest challenges for me. When I am busy and I have things that I'm trying to get done and something happens, it's so easy just to ignore it or to pretend I didn't see it or to let it slide this one time. And we have to take the time right then to take care of whatever the problem was. I remember one day, just a few weeks or a few months ago, Timmy had done something, and I had made him sit on a chair, and he'd been sitting there for a while, and I was feeding the baby, and then the phone rang, and it was one thing after another, and I kind of realized he was still in the chair, and so I said, well, Timmy, can you behave yourself now if I let you get down? And he said, well, yes, Mama, but aren't you going to talk to me? And I said, about what? He said, you know, about what I did. Well, you know, he needed that. He needed to have me come and talk to him like I always had talked to him about what he had done. He needed that security. He needed to know that he was loved and that what I was doing was right. There's a man that I've heard often say that he loves his child too much to discipline her. That's not love, is it? Sometimes when I look at my children and they're doing something little and I think, oh, you know, I'm too tired, I don't want to deal with this. Then I remind myself, you know, you might be able to get away with it now. It might not seem like it matters, but when you're 16 years old and you want the keys of the car to go somewhere, if I can't get control of the situation now, then I will never be able to say no then, and that really helps me a lot. We also should discuss the disciplining of our children in private. You know, I've heard a lot of mothers sometimes will talk among themselves about the way they've disciplined a child when their children are right at their feet playing, and that's really nobody's business but yours and your child's and what happens in your home. One thing that we've tried to do with our children is when we try to teach them that they need to obey us, is not only that because God said they should, but that so that they will be able to learn, it will be easier for them to obey God when they grow up, if they can learn to obey us now. We need to be able to train our children in heart attitudes, and we have to teach the principles behind the rules. If there are just rules, they're not going to mean anything. We have to teach the principles, and we have to teach the consequences. We have to teach our children that there are consequences, and sometimes I think it's good to teach our children that they have chosen the consequence of spanking or whatever. If we can say to them, if you do this, you are going to choose whether you do this or this, and if you act this way, you will not be disciplined, but if you do not obey, then you are choosing a spanking. This little Jamie I was telling you about, had heard this saying a lot of times when she would do something, she'd heard other people say, well, that's just a part of growing up. And one day she had done something really wrong, and her mother came to get her, to take her to the bathroom, and she looked up at her mom and said, well, Mom, that's just a part of growing up. And her mother said, but you know, Jamie, spankings are a part of growing up too. Spiritual training is also so important. It's also the responsibility of the mother and not just the father. There are situations where the father might not be a Christian or where the father really is not a leader in the home. And we can't just say that you know, it's not our problem, it's our husband's problem. There are ways that we can teach our children day by day without even maybe having devotions with them. There are so many ways that we can teach our children. I'd like to talk about that a little bit later. Another way that we build our monuments is by focusing on the inheritance that they will have, by focusing on the eternal. The only value strong enough to combat the destructive force of our world system is an absolute trust in God and a deep desire to obey the commands of the Bible. We need to be able to instill in our children not only a love of God, but a fear of God and a healthy respect and awe for God. One way that I tried to do that with my children, ever since they were really, really little, before they could even talk, I would look at them and say, you know, Benjamin, when you grow up, Mama wants you to be a man after God's own heart. I say that to them many, many times. And when they get older, I have said to them, what does Mama want you to do when you grow big? And they will tell me, love Jesus. And I know right now when they get older, loving Jesus will mean more. There is more to loving Jesus and to going to heaven than just loving Jesus, but that is how much that they understand at this point. And I tell them that over and over again because that is the most important thing to me. And I tell them it does not matter to me where you live, what kind of job you have, or what you do with your life as long as you love Jesus, because I know that loving Jesus is the core. And if that is taken care of, then everything else will fall in place. And my greatest joy is to know that my children walk in truth. So if we are building for an eternal inheritance, we need to focus on the character qualities that are of eternal value. Our children are going to try to become like the things that are important to us, but like the things that we focus on. And so we should focus and praise the traits that are character traits that we want to see in our children, and not on things like physical beauty. We have some friends who have three little children. Their oldest child is Laura, and she has real straight dark brown hair, and their second child is Elizabeth, and she's one of these little pixies that has blue eyes and blonde hair that's all curly. And little Elizabeth has heard so many times how pretty she is and how cute she is and how gorgeous her hair is. And she's only, I don't know, 3 or 4 years old, and they were sitting in a restaurant one morning. They went in, sat down, the waitress came over and looked at Elizabeth and said, "My, but you're cute." And she said, "Do you like my hair?" Well, why did she say that? Because that's all she'd ever heard. And if that's what we want our children to think about, then that's what we need to talk about. But if we want them to think about the things that are important to us, that's what we need to focus on. I remember one evening, Benjamin and Timmy were taking a shower, and I walked by the bathroom door, and I heard Benjamin say, "Timmy, you know what? I am so smart. When I'm at school and I work on that computer, I just press those buttons and I don't make any mistakes. I am just so smart." Now, he had had people at school telling him that, and that's where he got the idea. And so later that evening, as they were getting ready for bed, I said, "Benjamin, you know what I'm wondering?" He said, "What's that?" I said, "I wonder who was the kindest boy in your class today." And he just looked up at me. See, I didn't say anything about him being smart. I just want him to be able to think about the character qualities that are important to me. And we've talked a lot since then about being kind and being polite. And since then, he's talked about how he tries to wait to be one of the last ones in line, so that he's trying to be patient. If we focus on those things, that's what our children are going to want to become like. We need to focus on what is done right. Sometimes they make mistakes, but we need to focus on the good things out of what they have done. One evening, our family went for a walk. And we went out the road, and Benji and Timothy decided, and this has just been this summer, and they decided that they wanted to stay there and we should just go on. And so we expected when we came back around the bend, they would be right there at the cattle guard where we'd left them, and they weren't there. So we went on back to the house, and we were getting kind of worried because we could not find them anywhere. Well, what they had done, they had decided that they were going to surprise us. They went home. I mean, we're talking Timmy. Four, Benjamin is 5 and a half. They got in the bathtub, they took a shower, and they got themselves ready for bed to surprise us. Now, Timmy had his pajama top on inside out, and his buttons, you know, if you got something on inside out, the buttons were sticking out like this. And we could have focused on that and said, "Oh, Timmy, you got your pajamas on inside out, let me help you." But we didn't do that. I wanted to ask them if they brushed their teeth, and I didn't even ask them that, because that was not what was so important. What was important was the initiative that they had taken to do something special to surprise us. We need to focus on the traits that we want to see in our children. I've asked a couple of ladies in the last weeks to think about and write down the things that they would do differently if they were raising their children, and the things that they would do the same. And the one woman said that she would try to praise her children more. She feels like that is one thing that she did not do enough of. Another way we build our monuments is we build them by giving love. We need to stay in tune and in touch with our children. And that is an art that I think maybe mothers have a little bit above fathers. To be able to look at your children's face, at their eyes, and be able to see how they're feeling and if they're happy and if something's bothering them. Can you read your child's eyes? Do you know when they come home from school if something's wrong? Do you look at their eyes? Do you even look at them to see what's going on inside of them? We need to give love. We need to let them have tangible ways of knowing that they are loved. Something else I like to tell our children is, and I try to tell them this over and over again, is I am so glad that Jesus sent you to us. And I tell them, you know, I really like being your mama. Now, there are days when I might not like it as well, and those are probably not the days I tell them, but I tell them it's so much fun being your mama. That's the way that they can really feel that love. We need to make special days, and birthdays, and let them feel important. We can do that just by little notes we leave in their lunch boxes, or notes we leave by their bed or some other place we know they're working. Our love has to be tangible, because they're going to go where they have to go to get tangible love. And if they don't get it from us, they're going to get it from somebody else. Who do we want them to get that tangible love from? Another way that we give tangible love is to use eye contact. How many times have you come home, has your husband come home and he's picked up the paper and you've been trying to talk to him and, oh, he can hear what you're saying, but he's not looking at you. Does that ever happen to anybody? Anybody? You don't want to raise your hands here. You know, when somebody looks at you, you feel like they are really paying attention. We need to give physical contact by giving them touch, not just when we discipline them, but other times. And we need to give them our focused attention. I'd like to tell you a story about an experience I had when I was working in the intensive care unit at the hospital in Morgantown. I am a nurse, and I had been working there. And we had a little boy who was born with, he was either a spina bifida or there's something with it, I can't remember, but he had a growth or a tumor coming out of the base of his neck, and he was just a few months old, and he was not able to lie on his back because the growth was so big, and he could not lie on his stomach because he couldn't turn his head. He just had to always be on one side, and so the doctors had decided that they were not going to try to cure his problem, but they were going to try to make it easier to take care of him, and so they brought him into the hospital, and they took him to the operating room to do surgery. And when they tried to put the tube in him, in his nose that would go down to his lungs to help him breathe, his heart stopped. So they brought him to the intensive care unit, and we had him there for, I don't know if it was days or weeks, and they could not get him off the respirator. Every time they tried to turn the respirator down, he would not breathe on his own, and they knew he was not brain dead, but they didn't know what else to do, and they talked to the family and with the parents' only child, and they finally gave the parents a choice, and they decided that there was nothing to do but just to take him off the respirator and let him die. And so that evening in the intensive care unit, we notified all the visitors that we were postponing our visiting hours because we knew that we were going to be having a baby that was going to die. And we took a rocking chair into the small room that we had in the back. We didn't have any patients there, and we took the parents back there and told them we would bring the baby to them. And we put him in some clothes that the parents had brought, and we took the tape away from his face, and we wiped him all up so as soon as they pulled that tube, we could rush him back to his parents, and they could hold him while he died. We pulled the tube, the doctors pulled the tube, and we took the baby back to the parents. And we waited for that child to die. And a little bit later, I walked by the room. We had left the parents alone. And you know, when we took that baby to them, they were crying. And I walked by that door, and you know what? They were not crying anymore. They were smiling, because that little baby was smiling at them and cooing. That baby knew his mother's touch. He knew that feel. He knew that face. He knew that voice. And they took that baby home with them. And my sister worked in the pediatric floor, and she told me a few months later that they brought him in again and they tried to do the same thing. And when they took him down to the operating room and tried to put that tube in, he quit breathing and his heart stopped. And they brought him back and took him right up to his parents and said, "Take this baby home. We're not going to try to do anything with him." You see, that environment was not the kind of environment that child needed to thrive on. And our children need that touch too. Maybe not in the way that baby did, but our children need that touch too. Another way that we build is that we help them to develop a communication with God. Praying with and for our children is so important. As we listen to our children pray, we find out what is important to them. We should teach them to have intercessory prayer at an early age. I remember one day Dave's mother called me and told us about a situation in the home community there where we used to live. A man who had walked out in front of a car and had been hit, and he was an older man, and he had some broken legs, broken ribs, some internal injuries, and they did not expect him to live. And this man was Audra's grandpa. Now, Audra is one of Dave's brother's wives. And so our boys did not know Mr. King, but they knew Audra. And so they heard me on the phone, and I hung up the phone, and they wanted to know what was wrong. And so I told them, I said, you know, Audra's grandpa got hit by a car, and he's in the hospital, and he's very sick. And because I remembered what Dave's mother had done with Jamie when her mother was taking a test, I learned something from her that day. And I said, boys, why don't we stop right now and pray for Audra's grandpa? And they wanted me to pray first, and so I prayed, and then I helped them pray. And the one thing that I said was, help Audra's grandpa as he's in the hospital, help the doctors and nurses that take care of him. And you know, our boys have never forgotten that. They still pray for Audra's grandpa, who is now in a nursing home. This has been over a year ago. They still pray for Audra's grandpa as he's in the nursing home, help the doctors and nurses that take care of him. That's teaching intercessory prayer. And now sometimes when I'm writing a letter, they want to write a letter to Audra's grandpa. They don't even know the man. They've maybe met him once at their wedding, and they would have been too young to remember that. But that is something that they have learned about intercessory prayer. I tell Dave that sometimes, you know, our children pray about things that I didn't realize were that important to them. One evening, Timmy was praying, "Thank you that I could throw the ball on the roof." Well, I never realized that was a big accomplishment to him, but that helped me be in tune with him. Or, "Thank you that I can ride my bike," or "that we could go to the park." Benjamin often prays more about the people in our lives. He says, you know, "Thank you that Uncle Daniel and Aunt Grace could come to our house, and thank you that Uncle Mark and Aunt Rosie could come to our house, and that we could go to their house." That tells me what's important to them. One evening, Timmy prayed, "Thank you that Papa was going to build blocks if he had time, but he didn't have time, and he's going to build them tomorrow." So I let his Papa know that Timmy was counting on him building blocks tomorrow. So now that we've talked about the monuments about our children, I'd like to talk a little bit about managing. I was talking to a mother of three young children. She's a minister's wife this week, and I said, you know, if you were going to hear somebody talk about the art of being a mother, what would you want her to talk about? And she said, I would want them to talk about, how do you manage? How do you cope when all three of them are crying and you've got company coming for dinner? Well, I'm not sure if I have the answer, but there are some things that I have learned. One of them is to relax and to decide that you can be the calm in the center of the storm, or you can be part of the storm. It helps me sometimes just to find humor in the situation. I remember one evening we came home from church or Bible school, and all the boys thought they were hungry. They had to have something to eat, and Dave wanted something, and I was trying to wait on everybody at once and wasn't satisfying anybody. And finally, Dave said something to me about, you know, what's the matter with these kids? And I said, I don't know. I just work here, because that's what I felt like I was doing right then. And then we could laugh about that. Sometimes it helps just to do something positive. When you decide in those times, what is the most important right now? What matters most right now? And take care of that. Take care of our priorities. One thing that has helped me is if there is a situation that I'm dreading that we've been through and I think I'm never going to go through this again, is to find what are the stressful factors? What makes my life stressful with my children? And then doing something about it. For me, it used to be Sunday mornings, trying to get everybody up and ready. And if Dave was there to help me, it wasn't too bad. But during the wintertime, he manages a beef cattle operation. He has a lot of cows that are having calves, and he sometimes would hardly get back to the house in time to help me. And so I had to learn that some mornings I was going to have to be the one to take care of them and get them all ready. And so getting their clothes out the day before is something that helps me. If I don't have to do it in the morning, getting the diaper rag ready the night before, why wait till that morning? You know, as much as you can, do that ahead of time. I'd like to put a plug in for two books that have been really helpful to me in the line of organization. And the one is called Survival for Busy Women. And it's written by a woman who at one time had five children under her care, under the age of five. She had two of her own children, and her brother's wife left him, and so she had three of his children at the same time. Another book that she has written is More Hours in My Day, and I have copies of those books back there if you all would like to look at them, and also of some magazines that have been really helpful to me. Another thing that we need to do is to forget the advertisements. How many advertisements have you seen of a mother sitting on a sofa reading to her children, and they're in their pajamas, and they are clean, and none of them need any mending, and there are no toys on the floor, and there's no dust on the coffee table? I was talking to Joyce, the woman that I talked about a little bit earlier, about this, and I said, yeah, I was reading in this one magazine about a mother who wrote how she got up one night and stumbled across a couple toys to get to her baby and sat down in this rocking chair and was really tired and remembered an advertisement she'd seen on TV of a mother just getting out of bed and gliding across the floor to take care of her baby, and her hair was not a mess and there were no toys on the floor. And Joyce said, yes, and the moon was probably just streaming in the window, wasn't it? So forget the advertisements and get real, be realistic. It's not always that way. Something else, we've talked about a lot of things that are work, and I'd like to talk now about the things that I think are more fun, that are play. One of them is I'd like to talk about making memories. Think back to the memories of your childhood, the things that you remember that you were as you were growing up, things that you did with your mother or that your mother did, things that you did as a family. Think of the traditions, and what do you remember? What was the most important? When I think about the memories I have as a child, I think about the May baskets that my sisters and I used to do in the spring that my mother encouraged us. And I think about in the fall, my mother would pack a picnic supper once or twice a year, and she'd pick us up at school, and we'd drive around to look at the leaves. Those are some really treasured memories that I have. And that was something that we did that the only thing it cost was the gas in the car. I remember at Christmas time, we drive around and look at the Christmas lights that were decorated on the houses in town. I remember in the wintertime when it would be so cold outside, we had windows in our kitchen that did not have a tight seal, and Jack Frost would come in at night and paint pictures, not on the outside, but on the inside of the windows. And I don't remember that as being a time of, you know, that we didn't have money, that we were poor, because my mother didn't have that attitude. She talked about it as being Jack Frost and about the pictures that he had painted. And I'd like to just share something that I wrote to my mother on Mother's Day a few years ago that talks just about some of those things, because it helps me to think about the things that matter to me as a child as I look back. And this is just memories that I have to my mother. For teaching me to enjoy the robins who sing, the bright, fresh flowers which bloom in the spring, and helping me thank him for everything, thank you. For playtime in summer and allowing us fun, swimming and biking, stick horses that run, for calling us home when each day was done, thank you. For teaching me to enjoy the colors of fall, crimson and golden on trees grown so tall, sunrise and sunset, and all that we saw, thank you. For snowmen in winter and igloos and caves, enjoyment of Jack Frost, Christmas gifts that you gave, for loving and accepting as your son, my Dave, thank you. So, on rainy days, when it's drab outside, do something positive. Make a memory. When your children are sick, just stop and take the time to make a memory. There's a book by Gloria Gaither and Shirley Dobson that's called Let's Make a Memory. That is a really good book to read. Something that I like to do with my children that I have started is we have a project day, and I have tried to do that every Tuesday morning. We do a project, a special project. I've got some different books that give ideas, or sometimes we go on a walk. This fall we went on a walk and we gathered leaves one morning and I've got them pressing under a book now, and then another day we're going to do something with those leaves. It doesn't have to be expensive, but if we just take the time today, it's going to make a memory that is going to help our children later on. It's going to glue them to us so that when they get older, that glue will still be intact. Something that I like to do when our boys have haircuts is, you know, they get really tired of sitting still. Sometimes we have a flannograph story. I tell them stories about when I was a little girl, and I try to take those times to not just make a memory, but to teach them important principles. There are Christmas time, there are things you can do. There's the Angel Tree Project. There are needy families around that can become a tradition. One thing that helps make memories is to do things that are a tradition. Something else that I do with my children that some people I think I'm a little crazy is I let them help me bake. And they help me bake cookies, and I made aprons for all of them. And I get the cookbook out and I measure out the ingredients, and they dump them in, and I give them the eggs, and they crack them like this, and then I weed out the shells, and they crack them in a separate bowl, and then I dump them in. And you know, while we're doing that, we're making a memory, and they're pleasant memories for our children. sometimes it's hard to do those things. Those little things that are so important. I know one day Benjamin wanted me to, he built a big tower in the sandbox, and he wanted me to come out and dig a tunnel through it. And, you know, I just didn't think I had the time, and so I put it on my list of my things I wanted to get done that day. And it's a lot easier to do something if you have it on your list and you have to cross it off than if you don't put it on your list. So sometimes I have to put things like that on my list, and then I get it done. Just when you eat by candlelight. Special things like that that really don't take that much time or that much ingenuity even. Another thing that helps in making memories is laughter. Laughter is so important in the family. And, you know, if we can learn to laugh at ourselves and with our children, those are going to create some pleasant memories too. I remember one time my mother had been away. She'd taken some Amish people somewhere, and you know how when you go away sometimes and you come back and your mother would say to you, you know, if you're going to have to be grouchy like that when you've been away, then you just won't have to go away the next time. And one morning, we were out in the bakery making bread rolls. It was 5 o'clock in the morning, and my mother had come home the night before late, and she was a grouch. And I looked at her and I said, if you're going to have to act like that when you've been away, taking Amish people away, you just won't be able to go again. And she was able to laugh about that, to realize that she was being a little silly too. And we had a good laughter about that. We can still talk about that and laugh. We have time today to make memories, to do something with the moments that we have. There's a song that Bill and Gloria Gaither have written that I would like to share. It's called We Have This Moment. And I want you just to really listen to the words of this song, because, you know, we have today to do with whatever we want to, and we don't know how much time we have with our children, but we can do something with what we have today. This is called We Have This Moment. Hold tight to the sounds of the music of living, happy songs from the laughter of children at play. Hold my hand as we run through the sweet, fragrant meadow, making memories of what was today. Tiny voice that I hear is my little girl calling for mommy to hear just what she has to say. And my little son running there down the hillside may never be quite like today. Tender words, gentle touch, and a good cup of coffee, and someone who loves me and wants me to stay. Hold them near while they're here, and don't wait for tomorrow to look back and wish for today. Take the blue of the sky and the green of the forest, the gold and the brown of the freshly mown hay, and the pale shades of spring and the circus of autumn, and my friend, go out and weave you a lovely today. We have this moment to hold in our hands and to touch as it slips through our fingers like sand. Yesterday's gone, and tomorrow may never come, but we have this moment today. We need to recognize and seize each teachable moment. Deuteronomy 6, 5-9, you all have heard that passage many times. I'd like to just share a little bit of it. It says, and these words which I command thee this day shall be in thine heart, and thou shalt teach them diligently unto thy children, and shalt talk of them when thou sittest in thine house, and when thou walkest by the way, and when thou liest down, and when thou risest up. And thou shalt bind them for a sign upon thine hand, and thou shalt write them upon the posts of thy house and on thy gates. And later on in verse 12 it says, and beware lest you forget. The reason we're supposed to do this is so that we don't forget, and so that our children do not forget about God and about what he has done in our lives. We have a blanket at our house. We call it the Grandma Hilty blanket, and that's because Dave's Grandma Hilty made it, and it's just an old kind of a comforter thing. And we take it with us everywhere we go. We take it on picnics. We take it when we travel. We use it outside on the lawn to have picnics. And we use it in our house. And one day, We'd had a little girl at our house who had been using words like dumb and stupid to our children, and I didn't really like that, and I didn't want to concentrate on that, and so we had a picnic on the Grandma Hildy blanket in our living room, and while we were sitting there, we started talking about kind words. Instead of talking about words that are not kind and words that we should not say, we started talking about words that we can say that are kind. And Timmy said, well, what are not some kind words? And I said, well, when you say things like, I'm going to cut your arm off, that's not a kind word. But when I ask you to pick up the toys and you say, sure, that's a kind word. And so we were able to talk about that. That was a teachable moment. One day, I belonged to a group called Mothers and Others, and our group had been at a park for a picnic, the final picnic this past spring, and there were some other children there that were not involved in our group, and they had come with their bikes. And Benjamin wanted to ride those bikes in the worst way, and none of the children would share the bikes. And on the way home, he was fussing to me about how these children should have shared with him, and they were not being kind, and they were not sharing. And, you know, we'd had a little boy at our house a week before that had wanted to ride Benjamin's bike, and Benji wasn't very willing to share his bike. And so I said to him, Benjamin, how did it make you feel when those children would not share their bikes with you? And he said, it didn't make me feel very good. And I said, well, now you know how Robert felt last week. Now you know how it feels. Now next time you remember, that was a teachable moment. One day I was making cookies or something, and Timmy has a sweet tooth, and he's kind of sneaky, and I was here working, and he came up over here, and I saw this little finger going in the bowl, and I said, Timmy, don't touch that. And he said, how did you know I was doing that? And I knew why he wanted to know, because I wasn't looking at him. I said, Timmy, you know, God can see you everywhere you go, no matter what you do. You might think, you know, that he's not paying attention, but God can see you. That was a teachable moment. I try to tell him that God is everywhere and that it matters to God what we do. One day, Timmy was at the table, and I think it was a piece of gum he had, and I'm not advocating chewing gum because my children have it very, very seldom, and somehow he'd gotten this piece of gum, and he had it on the table, and he would not let go with it when he was eating lunch, and I'd asked him several times to please put it down and not mess with it, and he was not obeying me, and so I picked it up and put it in the trash, and he said, but Mama, I was going to stop, and I said, Timmy, I'm sorry, it's too late. I said, I told you, I warned you, and that's what happens. And he said, Mommy, it's never too late. And an hour or two later, he was still saying to me, Mommy, it's never too late. And I said, Timmy, you know, there is a time when it is too late. You know, we talk about loving God, and we say that if you love Jesus when you die, that you will go to heaven. But if you don't love him, that you won't go to heaven. And that is a time when it's too late, because if you die and you don't love Jesus, then it's too late. And I want you to remember that. Now, he's almost four, and a couple days later, our whole family was in the Walmart store, and we were pushing the carts along, and I heard Timmy saying to Benjamin, you know, Benjamin, if you die and you don't love Jesus, that it's too late. Did you know that? That was a teachable moment. He had caught that. I have a friend, Sean, who has a little boy. His name is Ian, and Sean was sick this summer with a disease called Lyme disease. And her little boy Ian had the disease as well. And Sean has been one of my best examples in teachable moments. And we had kept Ian for her for a week. And the first week that he was home, she was feeling a little bit better, and she had decided to walk out to the mailbox. And she told Ian to stay in the house, in the trailer where they live. And Ian is usually a very obedient child. And he probably was maybe testing her because he'd been gone from home. And she was walking back to the house, and she saw Ian outside. One reason she didn't want him out was because that they have a lot of ticks there, and that's how you get Lyme disease, and she didn't want him to get infected again. And she said to me, you know, she said, I was so tired, I was so sick, and I knew that physically I could not spank him. And she said, even emotionally, I didn't feel like it because he'd been gone from me for a week. And I said to him, Ian, what you did was wrong. You disobeyed me, and you deserve a spanking, but you know what? I'm going to show you mercy today, because that's what God does to us sometimes. He shows us mercy. And I think when Ian hears people talk about mercy, he's going to remember that, because his mother took that moment, was able to seize it and make it something to teach him by. There's a book here called Roses for Mama by Jeanette Oak. And this is a novel, it's not a true story. How many of you are familiar with this book? How many of you have read it? Okay. This story is about a family of children whose mother and father have both died. And the book deals a lot just with their grieving and their being able to cope and things that happen in their lives after their mother has died. And one thing that they start doing in this book is that they start writing down their memories that they have of their mama. And at the end of the book, the earlier memories are just things that they did, but at the end of the book, they are remembering more the things that she taught them, the way that she taught, that she was able to seize moments and teach them. And I would like to just share that, a little bit of this with you. Let's see where I want to start. So the oldest girl always writes down what the children are remembering so that they can look back on this later. And Derek, who is one about the middle child, says, "I remember one morning when I went out to feed the chickens and the mother cat was running across the yard with a little dead bird. I chased her and got it back. I cried and I brought it into Mama. She just hugged me for a long time and let me cry, and then she said, 'Son, don't fight death. Death, too, is a part of life. One thing dies that another might live. God is a wise God. He has a purpose for all things, even death, and for us, his special creation. Death is the only gate to eternal life. When the time comes for me to join him, though we might wish to linger a bit, it will be a triumphant time. Remember that.'" Derek stopped and swallowed hard. "I had forgotten that," he said, "until just now." And then little Sarah, who is the youngest one in the family, says, "I remember the little pink quilt Mama made for my dolly. I got the dolly for Christmas, and she didn't have any blankets, and it was cold. I remember. We shivered even in the kitchen that winter. Well, I wanted my dolly to be warm. I tried to hide her under my sweater, but then Mama said she would make her a quilt, and she did. And when she gave it to me, she said, 'Sarah, always show as much passion, compassion,'" corrected Angela softly. "'Compassion,' Sarah continued, 'toward others as you are showing for your dolly now. Share your warmth, Sarah. Share your love.'" Louise said, "I remember one morning when Mama came to call me for school. I didn't want to get up, so I thought I would just pretend that I was sick. Well, Mama laid a hand on my forehead, and she said there was no fever. And then she had me open wide my mouth, and she looked at my throat. She said it was fine. She pressed on my tummy here and there and asked if it hurt, and I said no. And then she asked me if I had broken my leg, and I said no again, so she said I must be really quite fine then. Nothing seemed to be wrong, so she told me to get up. And after breakfast, when Mama was kissing me goodbye, she held me close and said, 'Louise, don't ever try to pretend you are something that you are not. Folks always see right through the sham. Be true to others and to yourself.'" And then I'd like to talk about your magnitude as a mother, your far-reaching effect. There are a lot of biblical examples that we can look at. One of them is at Hannah, how she prayed for her son. One thing that I think about is that the coat that she made and took for him every year was something tangible that she could give to him. And Samuel never forgot who or whose he was. 2 Timothy 1:5 talks about Timothy and about the faith of his mother and of his grandmother. Look at Sarah and Hagar and their children. Look at the Isaac Ishmael effect that we have now because of a mother. Sarah was jealous of Hagar and her son and did not want Ishmael to have part of the inheritance. She was looking out only for her son. Look at that effect today. We're going to have an effect. We've got a magnitude, and you know, we can decide, we can let God work in us and decide what kind of a far-reaching effect God is going to be able to have in us. We need to pray for our children. In the New Testament, when Jesus and Peter were together one time, Jesus said to Peter, "Simon, Simon, Satan has desired to have you, that he might sift you as wheat. But I have prayed for thee, that thy faith fail not. And when you are tried, you're going to come forth as gold." Because Jesus prayed for Peter. And we need to pray for our children, and they need to know that we pray for them, and they need to hear us praying for them. And that is how we're going to have the greatest effect on the lives of our children. After we are gone, those prayers can still work, can still be in effect. Dave's mother is a woman of prayer, and she's had a tremendous effect on the lives of her children, the way she has raised them, and the way she's able to talk to them about things. They call it having Sunday school with Mom. When you've had Sunday school with Mom, you know you've been Sunday schooled, and sometimes it's not always been pleasant, but you come out of it a better person. She doesn't only Sunday school her children, but she Sunday schools her in-laws as well. And I'd like to just share something that I wrote to her about a year or two ago, thinking about the effect that she had on her children, how it has affected me today, because I'm benefiting from that, and my children are too. "I was looking at the curtains in our living room today, and I thought of you. You know why? Because you took the time and the patience to cut and sew and gather and ruffle and gather and ruffle some more. And they are beautiful and elegant and elite and gorgeous, and I am proud to tell people that you made them for me. I was looking at my husband the other day, and I thought of you. You know why? Because you took the time and the patience to cultivate and feed and teach and pray and teach and pray some more. And I have a husband who is wonderful and tender and gentle and kind and strong. And I am proud to tell people that he belongs to me after having first belonged to you. I was sitting in the chair in front of the fire the other evening, and I thought of you. You should know why. How does a mother find the time and the patience to nurture and cultivate and teach and pray and teach and pray so lovingly and unselfishly and carefully, and to give so willingly and cheerfully as you did all those years? And I wondered how you did it, how you accomplished all that you did with that bundle of energy and determination that God gave you those 33 years ago. If I can be the mother, confidant, and friend that you have been to him and to me and to our boys, I will feel that my life and career and motherhood will not have been in vain. I think of you so often during the day at times, and I just wanted you to know that your touch in our lives is cherished and loved and appreciated. Your prayers for our lives are coveted, and your love is a support and guide. I love you." And the last thing that I would like to talk about is, I'm sorry, there's one other thing I forgot to say, is that our children need to hear us pray for them and about them. I was listening to a mother came and shared to our Mothers and Others group this fall and talked about what's so great about being a mother. And one thing she said is that often, before her children go to school, she has started a tradition of stopping and holding hands with them before they walk out the door and praying for them. And just on the spur of the moment, they will say, "I have a test at 2:00, or I have this today, or this class is going to be really hard," and then she's able to pray for them. They make their needs known. A 15, 20-second prayer, she prays for them. Dave has a cousin, Gerald, who as a child one day was really worried about a test he had, and he asked his mom to pray for him. The test was going to be, I think, at 2:00 or something. And he came home from school that day, and she said, "Gerald, I remember to pray for you. How was your test?" He said, "Oh, Mom, you wouldn't have had to pray. It was easy." Little did he realize that maybe that's why it was so easy. So we've talked about a lot of things, not a lot about a lot of work and a lot of play. And the last thing I want to talk about is your memoirs. The definition of a memoir is that is a biography or a biographical account usually written by a relative or a friend of the subject. What are our children going to say about us when we're gone? Not that we're trying to flaunt ourselves, but they're going to say something about us. What do we want it to be? And we have to have some goals in mind, and we have to work toward those goals. You know, if you aim at nothing, you're going to hit it. We have to think about what is important to us. What do our children want us to remember that we have taught them after we're gone. About a year ago, I wrote something that came as a result of an experience that my sister had. My sister was at a funeral home at a service that they had for a relative on her husband's side of the family, and it was just a time for the family to share together what the person who had died had meant to them, and the impact that the grandmother had on their lives. And somebody in the group, in the family, said to her, "You know, I can't imagine doing this when my mother dies, because I can't think of anything good that I'd want to say about her." This was a woman who is a Mennonite, who is a Christian. And, you know, this girl maybe might have maybe she has some bitter problems, but, you know, maybe there was some truth in what she said. And it really made me stop and think about, what do I want my children to say about me as a Christian mother? What have I done for them that they will benefit from? And I would like to share that with you as a challenge to each of us. And I stop and think about this a lot of times when it's a busy day and, you know, they ask me to read to them or they want me to do something and I think, oh, I don't have the time or I don't feel like it. And then I remember that I want to make moments and that I want to make memories, that I want to have the time for them now so that they will be able to have time for God later and they will be able to remember the God that I serve in a pleasant way. This is called I Want to Be Remembered. The days move by so rapidly, and it seems there's barely time to notice all that's happening in this little house of mine. But moments come and moments go, and though it may be small, my children change from day to day, and I hardly see it at all. But when my days are over and it's time to say goodbye, I want my boys to remember that their mom could laugh and cry. I want when they should talk of me to know that they will say their mom could put a lot of fun into an ordinary day. I'd like to know they'll treasure the days we went on walks or the birds and flowers we identified or just how we would talk. I want to be remembered as a mom who found the time to make rolls and bread and homemade jam or their favorite apple pie. I want to be remembered by the little boys I own as a mom who let them help her bake or make cookies on their own. I want to be remembered by the little songs we'd sing, the rhymes we'd make together in the winter and the spring. Oh, I know that they'll remember that some days I was a grouch and fussed because they made a mess in my newly vacuumed house. But mostly I would want to know that they will someday say, when we tracked in lots of dirt, Mom would just clean it all away. I want to know they'll remember the little things I've taught, like washing hands and brushing teeth, saying, excuse me when you ought. I want them to remember the times that they were sick, that Mom would leave her work behind to hold and cuddle and kiss. I would want them to remember that Mom was never too proud to be wrong, and that she'd ask their forgiveness before the day was gone. I'd like to be remembered for usually tucking them in, for kissing them goodnight with a comradely little grin. I'd like to be remembered as a gal who loved her man and believed in him and respected him and was his greatest fan. I want them to remember the love they'd see us express, the security and strength they felt when love was at its best. I want to be remembered as a mom who believed in prayer, who took her fears and cares to God and was able to leave them there. I want to be remembered for the faith in God I own, for praying and for teaching them that in Him they are never alone. The days move by so rapidly, and as each one go, I say, what is it that I have done to make memories pleasant today? What is it, my little son, that I can do for you to make you glad that you're my boy, that I love you through and through? What is it that I can do today to help to make you mine So when the day comes that you reach that adolescence time, that you won't deny that I'm your mom and that you belong to me, that no question you can ask will be embarrassing for me. For when I'm gone, my boys will remember the days they spent with me. And if I take the time to make each one a pleasant memory, then as the days and months go by and roll on into years, the memories will hold them close through laughter and through tears. The days move by so rapidly, and I have time today to make them cheerful, happy, and bright, or to make them dismal gray. I want to be the kind of mom on whom they can depend. I want to be remembered for being not just their mom, but their friend. How do you want to be remembered? And what are you going to do about it today?
For more free resources that support teaching and learning, visit the docforlearning.org.